Thank you, Mark. That was a very kind introduction. And you also covered about my first four slides, so we're good. I've done a handout. So, I mean, we may want to turn lights on. So, because I've got some... hand those around. Some sort of poems and excerpts of writing from Stuart Kennedy for you here. Is it worth trying?
There we go.
Is that all right? And so Mark did ask me a little bit ago if I'd done this talk lots of times. And the answer is I've spoken about Stuart Kennedy quite a number of times, but I've not done this talk. And probably that's just because I have a very low boredom threshold and don't like doing the same thing again and again. And also, I suppose, partly I'd like to sort of tailor what I have to say to the audience. And so I think, you know, this is a mixed group sort of in terms of discipline, bright people, and all studying. So I hope you'll enjoy engaging with something of the thought, particular poetry and the prose of this man, Stuart Kennedy. And he was born in 1883, died, what seems to me, unbelievably early at the age of 45, which gives me a few months, I think. lived a remarkable life. And so we're talking about him, I suppose, as a poet and as a theologian. And I'm not sure that he's either a great poet or a great theologian. In fact, I think he's probably not either of those things. But personally, I do think he was a great man. And, you know, perhaps that's more important. And I think that by looking at his poetry and his prose and at something of his life, you get a sense of what it was that at least I think made him great. And by way of getting into that, I'm going to look just at two of the obituaries, or excerpts from the obituaries that were written about him at the time of his death in 1929. And so this is from the Daily Telegraph, one of our biggest sort of broadsheet papers. And it said of him, "The unhappy and the disinherited, the failures of this world, and the buffeted, seldom had a more heartening and valiant champion than Stuart Kennedy." And I have to say that this particular photographic portrait of him here is fairly flattering. So I'll show you a painted portrait. So whether he ever spoke to the artist again or not, I don't know. But in all honesty, having looked at a number of other photos, he looks a lot more like that than he does like the army photo. A man of intense vitality, glowing with compassionate sympathy, tortured by pity for human suffering, and feeling that he had a message for mankind, he gave himself with it, with an utterly reckless and unselfish generosity. May he rest in peace. And I think he did give his life, and poured out his life, probably actually worked himself to death. But Mark has already mentioned, I just want to deal with one thing quickly, that he's better known by his nickname of Woodbine Willie. And he was called Woodbine Willie by the soldiers on the Western Front during the First World War because his habit was to hand out to the soldiers on their way up to the front line for the big battles a New Testament and, I don't know about a packet, but a number of cigarettes. Woodbine cigarettes, which were about the most famous brand at the time, made by the Wills Company. And the soldiers christened him Woodbine Willie. And if you look on the handouts that I've given you, the very first excerpt is a poem which he wrote about the way in which the soldiers named him. And it's just called Woodbine Willie. And it says this: "They gave me this name like their nature, compacted of laughter and tears, a sweet that was born of the bitter, a joke that was torn from the years. Of their travail and torture, Christ's fools, atoning my sins with their blood, who grinned in their agony sharing the glorious madness of God. Their name, let me hear it, the symbol of unpaid, unpayable debt. For the men to whom I owed God's peace, I put off with a cigarette." So Woodbine Willie is the name by which he's most commonly remembered. And so in this talk, in the next sort of half an hour, 40 minutes this evening, I'd like just to take you briefly through the biography, the life of Stuart Kennedy, so that you have some context about who he was, the kind of life that he lived, what was important to him. I want to touch on the way in which throughout his life he found himself wrestling with suffering. He himself actually suffered, you know, through his life, particularly with sort of chest complaints, asthma, sort of related conditions. But more particularly, he was the kind of big-hearted person who struggled with the suffering that he saw around him in various contexts through his life. And so I'd like to sort of draw attention to that, because that was an absolutely, I guess, almost the crucible out of which most of his most interesting and most important thought came. But then I want to go on in 3, 4, and 5 here to look at the kind of the way in which he, as a Christian man, came to understand the Christian life in such a way that whilst he could never be reconciled with the suffering he saw, he didn't give up on his faith, which at certain points was a very real possibility. And so those 3, 4, and 5, wonder, the purpose of pleasure is just an excerpt, vision, the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ, and venture, the world has God's name written upon it. And those last three, wonder, vision, and venture, are one way of sort of providing a schematic overview of the way in which he understood the Christian life to be. And so wonder, he believed that humans could scarcely fail to search for the transcendent. That really, humans as he saw them around him from, you know, urban Britain through the trenches of the First World War and on, whatever their situation, seemed to always be longing for something more. And he believed that there was in that a sort of an inkling, a sense of what, you know, might be available within Christianity as a kind of answer to that longing of the human heart. And then he found that the place in which he personally found his answers was in the person of Jesus Christ. And then, having seen the face of Jesus Christ in some sense, some kind of vision, some kind of experience of Christ, he felt that Christians were then called to venture out into the world to try and address some of this suffering, not just to retreat into holy huddles to, you know, enjoy their spiritual life, but to really try and do something out there. And so in 3, 4, and 5, we'll look at some excerpts of his writing on these kind of topics and talk about them. So that's more or less the plan of what we're going to do. So first of all, a little bit about the biography, the life of Stuart Kennedy. And so really, his was a life that from the very beginning was exposed to very real poverty. So his father was an Irishman from around the sort of Dublin area, who went into the church and came to England to work with very deprived urban parishes in the north of England, actually in Leeds at the time of Stuart Kennedy's birth. And Stuart Kennedy was part of a very, very big family. So his father had 6 children by his first wife. His wife then died. Stuart Kennedy, Geoffrey Stuart Kennedy, was then the 5th of his children with his second wife, and I think she went on to have 2 more. So he was part of a huge family. And they lived in Leeds in a very deprived area, in a sort of house owned by the church, what we might think of as a vicarage. On sort of 2 sides of the street were just tenement kind of slums, state housing for those that worked in the factories and so on up in Leeds. At one end of the kind of street was a cemetery, and at the other end of the street was the very cheerily named Cemetery Tavern, which was the kind of pub or bar that all the people would go to. And so that's where he grew up, in a very large family. Most of his education initially was informal. He won a scholarship to a grammar school, a sort of selective state school, when he was 14, and then almost immediately won a scholarship to Trinity College Dublin to go to university. And although he won the scholarship when he was about 14 or 15, financial reasons meant that he couldn't actually travel there until he was slightly older. But he sort of, he took a degree there, got a first in classics and divinity, and won a prize for his academic achievement, and then came back to teach in schools in the UK, in England. But after a while of teaching, he enjoyed it very much. He enjoyed the young people, but he also felt a call to Christian ministry. And so I think in his sort of mid-20s or so, trained to become an Anglican priest after his father, and in fact, I think, his grandfather before him. And so when he went into the Christian ministry, it began to be apparent that he was very unusual in his sort of personality, in his style of ministry. He was, he had the sort of the Irish gift of the gab, perhaps. He would talk to anybody at any time, in any place. He was a larger than life character, perhaps compensating in some way for those features I showed you on the painting before. I don't know. And he was very funny and very humorous. And so a contemporary of his, when they were doing their first sort of curacy, when he was first working as a minister in Rugby in the Midlands of England, said this about him. "I can see again that small, slim figure strolling into the unattractive pub or bar where his beloved lodging house tramps, the sort of homeless, were to be found. And standing up in the bar in his cassock, so the black robe the priests wear, and singing Nazareth. And they loved him. Loved him for his great laugh, the smile that transformed his face, the inimitable Irish brogue, but most of all because of his love for them." And he turned out to be somebody who couldn't bear to see people around him suffering. And so it ended up that his housekeeper, the woman that sort of, you know, looked after the priest or whoever it was, used to take all of his pay, his stipend off of him when he was paid at the beginning of the month, and doled it out to him practically day by day to stop him from giving it all away. And in fact, in later life, after he'd been married, I think probably the most moment of crisis in his marriage was when his wife came home one day to find him carrying their mattress down the street. And basically he'd found an old woman who was dying sort of up the street, you know, was very unwell, didn't have a bed, and so he's, well, give her ours. And so he went back home and grabbed his mattress and took it down the street and into this woman's house and then got the rest of the bed. So he was that kind of character, quite remarkable. And after a curacy in Rugby, he went on and took up a parish eventually in Worcester, and he became a sort of parish priest there. But again, had made a very, very intentional decision to work in the poorest parts of the city with the poorest people. And after he'd been in Worcester for a year or so, the First World War broke out. And in 1914, Studdard Kennedy, Woodbine Willie, if he wasn't known as that then, but Geoffrey Studdard Kennedy is a parish priest, believed fully that the sort of the British, the Allied decision to go to war against Germany to try and protect France was entirely right, and he actively encouraged, you know, the men of his city to sign up, you know, for the sort of local battalions to go off to the First World War. But he didn't actually go immediately himself in 1914, and that's not any sense of hypocrisy, it wasn't any cowardice on his part. Simply, he felt that he had a job to do, you know, in the city where he was working amongst the poor, and like almost everybody else at the time, he assumed that this war would be over in a matter of a few months, certainly, you know, by sort of the end of 1914. But by 1915, it had become very clear that the sort of, you know, the battle lines had become bogged down, it had become a war of attrition, it had become clear that these, you know, British soldiers in the trenches desperately needed encouragement, needed help, needed spiritual, you know, sort of reinforcement, refreshment, whatever you might say. And so he left behind his parish in the Midlands of England and went to become a chaplain to the British soldiers on the front lines in on the Western Front in sort of France and Belgium. And again, he continued in a kind of ministry which was not really the norm. And he became very well known as an exceptionally gifted kind of public speaker. One of the very, very few, you know, kind of preachers, if you like, very, very few priests or ministers who could actually hold the attention, you know, of these sort of working class, mostly illiterate men who had other things on their mind than, you know, the sort of, you know, the Christian message. And so in the end, he was actually attached to what was in effect a traveling circus to kind of raise the morale of the men. And so he, as a priest, as a preacher, traveled around with a troupe of people which consisted essentially of a professional boxer, of two professional wrestlers, of a soldier who had the great feather in his cap of having killed 18 Germans with a bayonet in one engagement, and then stood at Kennedy, you know, the Anglican priest. And his style was, you know, that whatever he did, he just wanted to get involved with the people. So with the soldiers, he would do whatever they did. And so he would do all the kind of unarmed combat, you know, type training with them. And, you know, would wrestle and box and, you know, all that kind of thing. And people would say to him, why? And he said, well, after a man has had the exquisite pleasure of punching a chaplain's nose, he is more ready to listen to him preach. Which is not a particular view that I myself have. But that was his style. And again, you know, how do you measure effectiveness in that kind of context? But he certainly had the ability to get a powerful message across to those men. And he certainly, without a shadow of a doubt, was loved by those men. They respected him in a way that they respected very few other people. And some of that was to do with his humor, his manner. He would do the classic things of writing letters home for the mostly illiterate against soldiers, and would serve them in whatever way he could. But he also said, these men are my parish. Wherever my parish goes, wherever my parish is, that's where I have to go. And so although he was often called to do these kind of circus, big public speaking things, he made it a point to follow the men up to the front line into the worst of the battles whenever he could, because he felt that if he was to minister to them, then he had to be there in the absolute worst of it. And so, like very many chaplains, he worked effectively as a stretcher bearer, which, as you can imagine, was not pleasant work nor safe work. And again, a contemporary of his, when writing about him, said this: when the whistle blew for the advance, for the attack out of the trenches and into no man's land, he, stood at Kennedy, was in the midst. Once over the top, the men usually faced bullets and shells, with many mown down. He then sought out the wounded and the dying. The former he often dragged out of the mud, got onto a stretcher and pulled to the first aid post, ducking shells as they went. At times he lay down on his belly to comfort the dying. And in 1917, unusually for a chaplain, he was actually awarded the Military Cross. And the primary reason that he was awarded it is that during the midst of a horrendous battle, he was taking people back to the dressing station, back to the the front line, you know, hospital triage kind of center that they had, you know, very near the trenches and near the battle. But he found that they'd run out of morphine. And he talks about one, you know, very young man in particular, whose, you know, leg had just been blown apart, whose thigh was shattered, who was just in the corner of this sort of triage center screaming and screaming and screaming in agony. And stood at Kennedy, you know, very humbly, I guess, said, there was no bravery involved. I just couldn't bear the sound of this man screaming. And so he ran through all of the shell fire, through all of the, you know, the shell holes, through, you know, the horror of the war, to the main sort of hospital to collect morphine and take it back to this frontline dressing station. And for that, and then for the general sort of work that he did in rescuing wounded soldiers, and for his, you know, attitude in the midst of that horror, he was awarded the Military Cross. He made it back from the war safely, at least physically, if not perhaps psychologically, and continued to serve really the poor in the UK, went back to his parish in Worcester, continued to serve people there, became increasingly well known as an author and again as a public speaker, and in the end went to work for an organisation called the Industrial Christian Society. And that was a charity working in the UK at that time, whose aims and objectives married sort of very nicely with his own, in the sense that it was a Christian group that believed in, you know, in preaching the good news of the Christian message, but it was also a campaigning group working for the sort of, you know, better conditions for better employer-employee relations in the large factories and the big industries of England at that time, and then working wherever possible to alleviate the sort of the distress of the very poor and to generally improve their lot in life. And so through the later part of his life, from coming back from the First World War in 1918 through to his death in 1929, he was, as I say, a very well-known speaker and author who really, without a doubt, I think, exhausted himself by trying to work in a parish with his own sort of community, his own congregation, and then traveling all around the country preaching on behalf of this industrial Christian mission. And this is him standing at the back here in one of the crusades that he spoke of. And I find it very moving. I've said that I don't think he was a great poet or a great theologian. He didn't think he was a great poet or a great theologian either. And one of his last books, published just a year before his death in 1928, he said this in the foreword: "This book, I fear, is as full of characteristic faults and failures as every other I have written. I wish it were better done. I still dream of the day when, with ample leisure at my command and a full and adequate preparation, I shall be able to write down plainly what God means to me. But perhaps that is only a dream." And it was, because he died the following year. And so from his death in 1920, for a number of years, he was, he was remembered, he was respected, his writings were brought together in sort of books like this, The Best of Stuart Kennedy, some of the, biggest figures politically and sort of within the church at the time, wrote eulogies and, wrote a book about his life, a series of essays from different people who'd known him at different stages of his life. But, his reputation, I guess, has dropped off since then. And it's only probably now that we're around the centenary of the First World War that he's being remembered a little bit more. But so that's a sort of quick overview of his biography. I'll say quickly, are there any questions at that stage? Any gaps that people desperately want filled in? Anything of that nature? If not, I'll move along.
What caused his death, John?
So he died, essentially of flu, but with the complications around asthma. So he was... around Easter time in 1929, he was due to preach, a series of kind of Easter, Holy Week sermons up in Liverpool. And he was unwell, in those days, maybe about the 1920s, but traveling between the Midlands and sort of Liverpool wasn't easy. I think he became very feverish and unwell. He died up in Liverpool, unfortunately, actually before his wife could reach him to say goodbye. So it was just, he'd had a life of ill health. And generally, I think, wore himself into the ground. So that's a quick overview. With some of what he experienced, the work that he did amongst the poor, both in the early and later in his career, obviously the experience of the Western Front, of the front lines there, it's inevitable, perhaps, that he was going to wrestle with this suffering. How do you maintain, how do you hold a Christian faith in balance with seeing this kind of horror? And just to remind you of something, in one of the first slides I showed, the Liverpool Echo, that obituary talking about his being tortured by pity for human suffering. So just quickly, looking at some of the ways in which he engaged with suffering in peace, at war, at home. One of the things that was interesting about his work with the soldiers on the front lines is that, unlike most officers and chaplains, he refused to turn a blind eye to the kind of sex industry that served the soldiers on the front lines, to the brothels that would be in the towns and the villages just behind where all the soldiers were billeted. And he was absolutely adamant with the soldiers that he preached to, that this is not acceptable. Supposedly, young British Christian men must not use women in this way. And it would be tempting to think that that was some kind of theological or ideological or kind of, clerical, hoity-toityness. But actually, it was simply that, as a priest who'd worked in some of the poorest parishes in the UK, he had seen firsthand the devastation of what happened to the women who were caught up in those kinds of industries. And he basically said to the troops, it's murder. You are effectively murdering these women when you use them in this way. And this is just a little excerpt from one of his later books, actually, but he talks about an experience of going to minister to a prostitute in a common lodging house who was dying of pneumonia. And she lay there half uncovered on a dirty bed, and she kept muttering, "God damn all men, God damn all men, and curse their bloody bodies. And she died while I prayed." And that was the kind of thing which maybe none of us could walk away from unmoved. But once he had experienced and seen that kind of thing, it stayed, you know, in his heart and his mind forever, and he wrestled and he wrestled with it. In war, obviously, I mean, it's, you know, we've all seen, at least I'm sure, the films or read the books. There's not much more, perhaps, that can be said about the horrors of the trenches of the First World War. I've been obviously remembering Gallipoli over this last weekend in the Dardanelles and that sort of campaign against the Ottoman Empire, which again was horrible and primarily experienced by people from other parts of the world. This is just a poem of his, which is quite light-hearted in many ways, but also just, I think, cuts into some of that experience of the men. And a number of the poems that he wrote were called effectively dialect poems, in the sense that he tried to put them, you know, into the language, into the words of the men that he worked with on the front lines. And so this was his attempt. You'd have to imagine this being read, I guess, with, well, with his experience, probably not a Cockney accent, but with a very working class sort of English accent. So he called it The Spirit. When you've got an empty belly and the bully's rotten smelly and you're shivering like a jelly, carry on. Bully being the bully beef, the kind of tinned meats that the men used to eat. So fairly minor, you're hungry, tired. When the Boche had done your chummin' and the sergeant's done the rummin' and there ain't no rations coming, carry on. Still perhaps focused on their stomachs, they're hungry, there's no rum. But also your chums have been killed. When the world is red and reeking, and the shrapnel shells are shrieking, and your blood is slowly leaking, carry on. When the broken, battered trenches are like bloody butchers' benches, and the air is thick with stenches, carry on. So he experienced, you know, all of that. The broken bodies, the troops like butchers' benches, the smells and the sights of that. And then at home, and this I've put in full actually on your handout, which you can either, I'll read it out now, and you can read along or save it for later. But actually, personally, I consider this one of his best and most moving poems, but that could be purely me. And it's called The Pensioner. And as you'll understand, it's about a woman whose husband has been terribly injured in the war, and she's a pensioner because the government pays her, you know, effectively for, you know, the incapacity of her husband. So this will take a few minutes, but let's go through this. And again, this is a sort of dialect poem. He's writing in as close an approximation as he can manage to this working class woman's voice and vocabulary. So him and me was kids together, played together, went to school, where Miss Jenkins used to rap us on our knuckles with a rule. When we left, we worked together at the factory making jam. God have mercy on us women. I'm full up today, I am. Well, I mind's the August Monday when he said he loved me true, underneath the copper beech tree with the moonlight shining through. Then we walked down by the river, silent like and hand in hand, till we came there by the ketchin where them two big willows stand. There he caught me roughly to him, and his voice was hoarse and wild as he whispered through his kisses, will you mother me, my child? And I took and kissed him, sweet as love and long as life, vowed while my breath was in my body I would be his faithful wife. And I seemed to see his baby smiling as he lay at rest, with his tiny hand a-clutching at the softness of my breast. God above, them days was heaven. I can see the river shine. Like a band of silver ribbon, I can feel his hand in mine. I can feel them red-hot kisses on my lips or on my hair. I can feel his arm tight round me. God, I tell you, it ain't fair. Look ye what the war's done at him, lying there as still as death. See his mouth all screwed and twisted, with the pain of drawing breath. But of course, I have a pension, coming regular every week, so I ain't got much to grouse at. I suppose it's like my cheek, grousing when a grateful country buys my food and pays my rent. I should be most humbly grateful that my John was one as went to fight for king and country like a hero and a man. I should be most humbly grateful, and just do as best I can. But my pension won't buy kisses, and he'll never kiss again. He ain't got no kissing in him, ain't got nothing now but pain. Not as I would ever change him for the strongest man alive. While the breath is in my body, still I'll mother him and strive that I keeps my face still smiling, though my heart is fit to break, as I lives a married widow, so I'll live on for his sake. But I says, let them as makes them fight their wars and mourn their dead. Let their women sleep forever in a loveless, childless bed. No, I know, it ain't right talking, but there's times as I am wild. God, you don't know how I wants it, how I wants a child, his child. So the suffering of the war didn't finish at the close of hostilities with the signing of the Versailles Treaty. And yet, in spite of being very compassionate, very moved by all of these experiences, he did actually continue to believe the Christian faith and to hold on to the Christian hope. And even in the midst of the trenches, even in the midst of the horror of the devastation and desolation there in the sort of north of France and Belgium, he continued to believe that, and in fact to say that those places would once again, you know, be effectively reborn, that new life would come back. And his hope for the kind of physical landscape was allied with his hope of a Christian sort of remaking of the world in Jesus Christ, ultimately, eternally. And so I'd just like to look, you know, briefly at this sort of understanding he had of the pattern, if you like, of the Christian life, and beginning with wonder, and a particular piece of writing of his on, if you like, the kind of the purpose, the deep purpose of pleasure. And again, I think you'll find that this piece of writing is on the handout. And it starts, again, with a piece of poetry. I don't think he ever actually published this anywhere fully as a poem. It comes just as a, you know, sort of an excerpt in the midst of one of his prose books. But he says this, this is under wonder on your handouts. In the midst of life, we are in death. Its shadow falls over everything. 'Twere heaven enough to fill my heart if only one would stay, just one of all the million joys God gives to take away. If I could keep one golden dawn, the splendor of one star, one silver glint of yon bird's wing that flashes from afar, lift ye up your hearts to God. If I could keep the least of things that make me catch my breath, to gasp with wonder at God's world and hold it back from death, it were enough. But death forbids. The sunset flames to fade. The velvet petals of this rose fall withered, brown, decayed. O grave, where is thy victory? O death, where is thy sting? Thy victory is everywhere. Thy stings in everything. And then he goes on in this book, a book called The Wicket Gate, which he wrote near the end of his life. And he says, there's a stage in a small child's life when one of its greatest joys is to be taken up by its father and swung in the air. And I can see now my own small son standing before me when I have just put him down and saying with shining eyes, do it again, Daddy, do it again. And in him I see a picture of the whole world of men and women standing before the great All-Father who makes the sunset and the rose and crying as they fade and fail, do it again, Daddy, do it again. Always trying to recapture the ecstasy and never quite succeeding. There is only one way by which we can ever capture and hold fast forever the joys that come and go. That is by capturing and holding fast the Father himself from whom they come. Always we must stand in a world of dying things and dying people, crying out through our tears, do it again, Daddy, do it again, until the moment comes when the Father reaches down, snatches us to his heart, and holds us there forever. The more we grow in the love of beauty, truth, and goodness, the more completely human we become, the more intense must grow our hunger for immortality and our abhorrence of death. And so he believed that in sort of human experience of the natural world, perhaps principally and above all else in human experience of love and relationships, there was this sense of longing, this sense of the wrongness of these things coming to an end, you know, of the sunset fading, of the flowers dying, you know, of the loved one dying. And his belief was that that human longing, in some sense is natural, you know, pointed towards the fact that perhaps humanity, being human, perhaps life, is about more than just this broken world. And so where does that kind of longing lead? Well, for him, it led to the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And that's a phrase which just occurs again and again and again through his writings, right from the very first books that he wrote during the First World War, when he effectively was keeping journals in the midst of the trenches, and then they were published afterwards, through to the books that he wrote right up until his death in 1929. And why was Jesus Christ so important? It was because he saw in Jesus Christ the suffering God, not the omnipotent sort of monarch who sat peaceably up in his heaven and looked down on this suffering, but upon the God who had entered into the very dregs of human experience. And in the midst of the First World War, he talks about an experience that he had where he once again found himself running through no man's land under shell fire, you know, in his own words, terrified, scared out of his mind, relieved that at least he knows which direction is safety, he's running in the right direction, and he's running through a copse of trees, like a small wood, what's left of it, and he stumbles over something and he falls. And having fallen to the ground, he looks back to see what he's looked over, or what he's tripped over, and he sees the body of a very young, thin, undernourished German soldier. And he says that in that moment, it seemed to me that that boy disappeared, and in his place there lay the Christ upon his cross. And he cried, "Inasmuch as ye have done it unto the least of these, my little ones, ye have done it unto me." And he said that from that moment on, he couldn't see a body lying dead. He couldn't see a body in intense suffering. He couldn't see a person in agony without seeing a crucifix. And so this verse, which I've just kind of preceded, but from 2 Corinthians 4:6, became absolutely central to him. "For God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ." And he took huge comfort from the fact that the Christian faith is not centered on an image of might or power or self-satisfaction, but upon, you know, this image of God actually suffering in the person of Jesus Christ. And he would constantly say again as his refrain, "I don't understand some of these big philosophical questions. I don't quite understand how we can think of an omnipotent, omniscient, you know, all good and loving God presiding in some sense over this horror. But Jesus Christ I know and love." And he wrote quite beautifully, I think, of Jesus Christ. And again, on your handouts under vision, there's this excerpt from a book of his called Food for the Fed Up. And he's here, obviously, talking about Jesus. And actually, it's interesting for us, C.S. Lewis was writing, obviously, at a not dissimilar time to this. And his writings are still celebrated today. This passage and the kind of context where it comes is very similar to the sort of classic C.S. Lewis passages where he talks about, you know, you can think of Jesus Christ as being, you know, what's the sort of, what are the phrases? But, you know, he could be a bad man, or he could be a madman, or the God man, but he can't just be a good man, you know, this kind of idea that there was something about Jesus which completely and utterly transcended any kind of human goodness. And stood at Kennedy's taking a similar line in this chapter of this book, and then he goes on to say, "He, Jesus, was a mad fanatic who played with children. He was a morbid Puritan who declared war on natural instincts, and was called a glutton and a wine bibber and the friend of the harlots who forgave the woman taken in adultery. He was a ridiculous visionary with his eyes fixed on heaven, who was always telling men that their first duty was to love one another and do good in this world. He was a megalomaniac madman who was always talking about himself as king of heaven and always thinking about other people and living the simplest and humblest life of kindly service. He made himself equal with God and forgave the men that spit on his face. He was a weak and womanish pacifist who would not strike an honest blow, who faced the cross with the dignity of a hero and died unbroken at the end. He was impossible and infinitely appealing. If you set out to follow him in earnest, you may say in your heart that he is the God of unutterable beauty who breaks the hearts of men, but you will cease to use the cant of the critic who calls him a very good man." And so throughout his life, he was, in the best sense of the word, I think, obsessed with the person of Jesus Christ as he encountered him in the gospel and the worship of the church. And then finally, Venture, his belief that the Christian life wasn't something to be lived behind closed doors on Sunday mornings, but was something about being out in the world and in all of the world. And again, in another of his later books, he talks about being in his sort of church in the vicarage, the rectory, whatever, and going through some old books. And not long ago, looking through some of these old books, I came across a series of lessons for Sunday school children. It gave me the creeps to read. The child was taught that there were three things in the world which bore God's name: his book, his house, and his day. And then again, the first of the three excerpts on that final column of your handouts. He carries on this same passage. "There is nothing in all the world, except what is evil, which has not God's name written upon it. All things are his, and all things must therefore be used carefully and only for the right purpose. All days are his days, all books are his books, all houses are his houses. If our finding of God in the churches leads to our losing him in the factories, it were better to tear the churches down, for he must hate the sight of them. If we seek our God in the sanctuary and pass him by in the street, it were better to break up the altars." And I've just finished with two passages here, one really addressing, in the broader sense of the word, the sciences, and one, the arts. Because he had this passionate belief that, you know, not everybody was called like him to be a minister, to be a priest, you know, of the church, but every Christian was called to serve God and to work for the transformation of the world in whatever field of endeavor it was that God had placed them. And I think these are nice for us as sort of postgraduates, as those involved in sort of academic enterprise. And so he says here, "Our Father is the beginning and the end of science, as it is the beginning and the end of life. For the beginning of science is the supposition that the world is in reality a rational world, and the end of science is to understand and so hold communion with that rational reality. The beginning of life is the supposition that God is love, and the end of life is to comprehend with all the saints what is the length and breadth and depth and height of that love which passes knowledge. So science and religion meet, and in the end are one." And then a final reading before we finish. "The glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ, in a thousand different forms, in passionate poetry, majestic music, in a blaze of perfect color, in mysteries of arch and aisle, in splendor of white steeples and strength of massive towers, the cry has been echoed down the ages. Thine is the glory for ever and ever. Amen. It is in Bach's Mass in B minor. It is in the spire of Salisbury and the towers of York. Words fail me. What more can I say? Just the steady, sober truth of my own lost soul in the dark without him." So, the life and writings of G.A. Geoffrey Anketell stood at Kennedy. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
you want me to?
Whatever. I mean, I'm, you can fill them or I'll fill my own, whatever you.
Yeah, okay.
If there are any thoughts, comments.
Yeah, thanks for a great talk. That was excellent. I was curious if he had ever theologically focused on God suffering in the form of Jesus Christ and coming across wounded soldiers and seeing a crucifix and that kind of thing. Did he ever reflect on the other side of it, the fact that they were also soldiers engaged in executing violence, or if that had ever come up?
That's really interesting. So he became, so as I say, in 1914, along with, you know, almost all of his contemporaries, he thought it was a just war. He thought it was the right thing for the Allies to be resisting what was perceived as aggression. It was aggression. He came out of the war a complete pacifist. He didn't believe that the war could ever be justified on any grounds. He certainly didn't think it could ever be justified on Christian grounds. And so clearly, you know, the First World War, you know, both armies, you know, with actually very similar kind of Christian beliefs, believing they had God and right on their side, you know, he became a pacifist is probably the primary answer to your question. But it was more, his own reflecting was much more on the impact, the suffering of war. And it's interesting, something I'd like to look at in more detail. I actually wrote my DPhil on a German theologian who was a chaplain in the trenches on the German side, and also went into the war following the Kaiser, believing this was God's will for them as a nation. Also came out of it believing, you know, as in effect as a pacifist, believing it had been a mistake, but on the losing side, you know, in that case. And I think that was an even more destructive and difficult thing to come to terms with. But he came out a pacifist. Yeah.
So he comes across quite self-deprecating in your presentation.
Yeah.
Did he have any kind of contemporary critics or people who didn't really agree with the way he eulogized or the way he preached?
Yeah. So great question. He had critics all the way through. When he was a very sort of new minister, he used to preach and people loved his sermons. But his sort of, you know, his boss, I think effectively his bishop, said basically, if I hear one more heresy from you, you're fired. And so there was that kind of level. He was always quite a, you know, an imaginative sort of free thinker, kind of went with his gut, I guess. And then during the First World War, as I think I sort of mentioned, he actually published both poems and talks that he gave on the front line. And I've got the quote here. But his he wrote a book called The Hardest Part, which was a series of sort of reflections that he wrote, you know, in the trenches. Each one is actually dated, you know, and he gives, it's this time of day and I'm sitting here and we've just had a battle, or I can, you know, whatever. And that's where he really wrestles most explicitly with this problem of, you know, classic Christian sort of theology and suffering. And, you know, he says some things which, you know, would generally be considered heretical. So this is just an example from that book, The Hardest Part. God is helpless to prevent war, or else he wills it and approves of it. There is the alternative. You pay your money and you take your choice. If God wills war, then I am morally mad and life has no meaning. I hate war, and if God wills it, I hate God, and I am a better man for hating him. That's the pass it brings me to. And so when this, and he goes on, but when this book was published, it was, you know, caused a lot of consternation, you know, amongst both church and political hierarchy, obviously. And I think, you know, as I say, I kind of tailor these, you know, talks a little bit to what I think will be of interest to the audiences, but if you had a group of sort of theologians and philosophers here, you could have a very interesting discussion on sort of, you know, passibility. Does God suffer? Does Jesus suffer? Does the Trinity suffer? And I would say, I mean, he takes a very, very clear line that God the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit suffers. And he also, I think, definitely during the war, although he rose back slightly through his life, takes what theologians now might think of as sort of open theism. So he believes that God has limited himself to such an extent in his dealings with humanity and with creation that actually that God can't stop war, actually. and he wrestles to reconcile that kind of sense that God has so limited himself that we can't blame him for war. He's given so much freedom to creation that we can't blame him. With how can we then be confident enough that that actually in the end it will be well? And so that's kind of very much what he wrestles with. And clearly that that worries a lot of people.
Thanks.
Is there any evidence that he did have this crisis of, you know, his conscience and his faith? Did he, you know, would you say that he fell away at some point and then came back?
No.
Nothing as serious as that.
No, so I think...
Because those words sound...
Yeah, so I think arguably, or I think almost certainly, he fell away from what would be considered kind of doctrinal orthodoxy, the classic kind of positions of, you know, the Christian church. I don't know that there's any... So when he says here that he hates God, he's talking about he hates the image of this omnipotent king sitting on a throne, safe up in heaven, looking down unmoved by the suffering of the world. And so it's that image really that he hates, and he thinks that that's a less than Christian image of God. He probably thinks that's a kind of philosopher's view of God in some sense. So I don't think he ever considered sort of turning in his kind of, you know, clerical collar or giving up. I don't think he ever stopped believing, but he definitely pushed beyond what would be considered classic Orthodox theology. Michael.
Well, given that, I wonder, did he have any major influences in his own thought or his own poetry? Did anybody he sort of studied when he was at Trinity College Dublin,
yeah,
or in his training that he sort of saw as kind of an exemplar for him?
Yeah, that's a great question, and the honest answer is I don't know the answer. So, you know, I came across this guy a long time ago when I was in my early 20s, happened to hear somebody read a poem of his, one of these dialogue poems, and I really, to be perfectly honest with you, no interest and no knowledge or skill in poetry, but I found it immensely gripping and different to anything I'd ever heard. And over many years, sort of tracked down quite a number of his books, and just recently had the opportunity to write this book about him. But it's very much a devotional. This is my book here, right? Sometimes, which Mark very kindly mentioned, but it's very much a devotional book. But I think there is a serious work of scholarship to be done, you know, on sort of what, you know, what influenced him, how did he come to these positions. Because interestingly, I don't think he's a great theologian. One of the undoubtedly great theologians of the 20th century is a German man called Jürgen Moltmann, who is very famous for introducing this idea in the 20th century of God's suffering, not just in the person of Jesus Christ, but all of God's suffering, albeit in slightly different ways, in, you know, God's relation to the cross. And Jürgen Moltmann, pushes back very hard against this kind of unmoved mover, which he considers to be a kind of import from Greek philosophy to Christianity. And so he is a huge theologian for any academic theologian of the 20th century. And he actually, I don't know any of his books, but in interviews, references Stood at Kennedy as being a major influence on him in that area. So in fact, I think, you know, Moltmann says that this guy was actually one of the most influential theologians of the 20th century for that reason, that he was one of the first people to articulate this idea that we can't, as Christians, make sense of this world if we have this incredibly strong account of God as the monarch in heaven, unmoved by what's going on below.
Sorry, I was wondering, is there any reflection on him about how to bear suffering? I mean, apart from the issue, does God suffer, but how,
yes,
the human being rooted in God,
yes,
deals with it?
Yeah, so the answer is, he does deal with that. At length and in lots of places and with lots of kinds of suffering. Towards the end of his life, actually, he wrote a lot about relationships, about particularly sort of marriage, if you like, because he saw that as somewhere which, you know, is intended, if you like, by God to be a great good, and in many cases turned into the most horrendous suffering for people. And he spent a lot of his time counselling couples. He was given a sort of church in central London by the church authorities in the later part of his life, just to earn him a living, just so that he was then freed up to, you know, do his itinerant ministry, which didn't really pay anything. But in that very, very wealthy sort of part, literally, it's actually about less than 100 metres from the Bank of England, right in the centre of the city, He had lots of very, very wealthy people who suffered in a very, very different way, but were suffering. So the answer is, yeah, he talked about it a lot. And he talked about how, as Christians, we should respond to suffering, you know, in different ways. So I don't, you know, I think he'd seen so much, he didn't think there were any easy answers. He didn't give you a kind of, you know, 5 points to be free of your, you know, sort of emotional baggage or whatever. But he certainly talked a lot about the practicalities for Christians, and a lot of his later books, you know, were in part at least dealing with suffering and so on. So, but it'd be like, I can give a summary.
Thanks.
You go first, I've already
had a good call. Did he talk much about the, I guess, the work of Christ and the work of the Spirit during the war and, like, during and through suffering? Did he sort of have observations about that?
No, I don't think he had a huge amount of time for the kind of, you know, what we might think of kind of Irenaean, you know, that we're perfected through suffering. I think he saw it essentially as an evil, I think, to be avoided at all costs. So which, you know, I'm sure he would have had a belief that God could, you know, use it in people's lives in some ways, but it wasn't his approach to sort of ask what is God doing in this, or what's going on. He did have a very strong belief, and I think it's one of the things that kind of broke his heart in later life. He did think that this huge crisis in kind of in Western civilization might draw people back to Christianity. And in many ways, I look at that and think, man, that's ridiculously over-optimistic, because Christianity is so implicated in, you know, in what happened with both sides, believing they were fighting just Christian wars, but their kind of national churches behind them. But he did, you know, he did believe that out of the horror of war might come revival. But obviously, you know, didn't see that happen. So at a kind of macro level, I think he had a sense that this could be a kind of moment of crisis in civilization that might return people. I don't think he saw that so much in individuals' lives.
Well, how about the working of the Spirit in individuals' lives in order to, like, bring about change? Like, for example, in the relationships and things like this.
Yeah. So he doesn't. He's huge on Jesus. If we're thinking about the persons of the Trinity, he kind of resists very, very strongly the kind of the monarchical, you know, kingly sort of thing of God the Father. And he's pretty quiet on the Spirit, frankly. He doesn't have a huge amount of stuff on the Holy Spirit. You know, in references, obviously, but he doesn't really seem to have much of a theology in that sense of thinking. So it's, you know, he does, you know, this thing about vision, he does, you know, he believes that people encounter Jesus Christ in different ways. And I'm sure he would see that as a work of the Spirit, but it's kind of seeing Jesus for who he is that he thinks is transformative.
That's an embarrassing theological question.
I don't know, it's embarrassing for you or me.
So when you see a changed life, right, when you say, you know, God is at work in my life, and, you know, if someone else says this, and they say, you know, this is why I'm a Christian, and I've seen God work in my life. As a theologian, would you say that is the work of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit?
I mean, not like
you're mutually exclusive, but
yeah,
like,
yeah.
How do you frame that?
I don't know. Work of the Father in the Son through the Spirit, surely that's the answer. I don't know that you can unpick that. Maybe other people in the room can.
Maybe my reason for asking is because I had this really interesting conversation with a friend over the weekend who's very sympathetic to Christianity. Mm-hmm. He's also very a brilliant guy. It sort of came down to, anyway, that he wouldn't be a Christian. He is not a Christian because I guess what he finds most attractive about Christianity is its emphasis on, you know, the value of humanity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I tell this lovely story about the Incarnation, mm-hmm. and how this, you know, speaks to that. However, he thinks that if there is no God, this value is still basic, this value is still there. Mm-hmm. And we don't need a divine being to secure that value.
Yeah.
And so I'm sort of, as we're sort of talking through this, I'm thinking, like, this is really interesting because he really identifies with Christ and the suffering mm-hmm. Christ, and there's a lot of passivity. And I was thinking about this over the subsequent days and thinking, why am I a Christian? You know, what is it that draws me? Because I always talk about Christ. Mm-hmm. But there's something about, like, the way that Christ, with the Spirit or you know, God, you know, works in my life and works in other people's lives around me. And that's, like, I see, like, there's something happening. Like, there's like, an actual, like, there's something at work. There's, like, an agency or something. It's a divine agency. And then I guess on top of that, I also think that, so another thing, he seemed to agree with this, but is that the content of Revelation and, you know, the person of Christ actually, like, provides us with content mm-hmm. that we otherwise don't have. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of stuck with this slightly more naked, you know, framework, right? But I guess the thing I was trying to avoid and mm-hmm. trying to sort of, you know, chasing myself to avoid was this Kantian idea that, you know, really we sort of have these basic values, like human dignity, fairness, and whatever. But then religion, like, helps sort of prop those up, right? And kind of supports those.
Yeah.
But the religion is really accidental to, like, the, you know, like, inessential to the meat of it, right?
Yeah.
And that this is the position my friend has.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking through this, I'm thinking, like, maybe, you know, speaking to, or, like, thinking through the work of God through this could provide a lot more, like, kind of, yeah. I don't know, I wonder what he had to say to that, seeing that he saw so much suffering.
Yeah. So I think I'll give you the kind of my personal, you know, response, what that makes me think of. So a lot of my work in theology has been involved in wanting to see God at work beyond the kind of the sphere in which the Christian gospel is explicitly preached, or beyond the sphere in which, you know, Christians are active, even if you like. And I want to say that I want to talk about the Holy Spirit primarily being at work there. But the question that you keep coming back to, which I don't have an answer to, is that you know, you need some kind of, you know, plumb line or criterion or whatever to decide where is it the Spirit's at work and where not. I mean, it's an obvious point, isn't it? And so I have lots of friends, and probably almost finished this chat myself, where, I can't even think now, but 3 or 4 years ago we were celebrating the Arab Spring, you know, kind of, and wanting to see, you know, God and the Spirit, you know, at work in that, because that looked like a, you know, a sort of a breaking down of destructive, oppressive structures and all this kind of thing. And now, a few years later, you look back at all of that and think, my goodness, there aren't many places where that's gone well. And there are a heck of a lot of places where it seems to have, you know, resulted in more oppression or more suffering or more whatever. And so literally, you know, in the sort of months since I read this book, a number of times I have got all of his books that I have, which is probably a dozen or so, and I've thumbed through them because I know there are some, well, there's one sort of chapter where he talks about a way in which, you know, you can see Jesus Christ as that kind of plumb line, you know, as a way, and it's not original, but in this chapter, whatever, he does, you know, what I think is a brilliant, brilliant job of, you know, how do we see God at work, but still be assessing it through, you know, the person of Jesus Christ and something, particularly the suffering person of Jesus Christ. And I can't find it. It's driving me crazy. But when I do, I'll come back to you.
That'd be so interesting, because, like, because Kant's, you know, one of his oft-quoted mm-hmm. phrases is, even the Holy One of the Gospel is judged by the moral law,
mm-hmm.
which we all sort of have. So it really kind of,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, it's kind of
sort
weird.
Of takes transcendence
yeah.
down.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, that was really interesting. My question was more if he seemed to be this kind of man who was one with the people, be that like the workers on the
mm-hmm.
factory floor, the poor, the people in the trenches. But I was wondering when he saw his role to speak to the establishment or the political and economic elite of his time, be that addressing the war, or be that also, you know, at the same time, it's like, depending on where you are, but the head of the imperial project, the colonial project.
Yeah.
So the first question is kind of the breadth of his view of suffering and the, and the role of where he was situated within that. But then secondly, did he see his role also speaking to a different audience, which wasn't the factory floor?
Yeah.
And if he did, what did that look like?
Yeah. So he absolutely did see you know, himself as wanting to be, you know, a voice for the voiceless. And so he absolutely was willing to address the powers that be, certainly in terms of the kind of, you know, the military machine. I think, again, towards the end of the war, he went from being, you know, a very useful kind of morale and propaganda tool for them, you know, for the British kind of military hierarchy, to being a thorn, you know, in their sides, in terms of just, you know, being absolutely adamant, there is no way we can, you know, be carrying on like this, that surrender or whatever else would be infinitely better than, you know, continuing this carnage. And similarly to the political powers, you know, he's got one book called Democracy and the Dog Collar, which is a kind of extended sort of imagined conversation between, you know, if you like, the kind of communist, you know, sort of People's Party and him as a clergyman, and he's trying to find a way in this kind of imagined conversation of, you know, of convincing, if you like, the workers that actually together we can be stronger rather than it being, you know, a complete opposition. And, you know, at times was quite revolutionary in his, you know, sort of in his politics, and was, you know, on the edge of being involved in sort of almost, you know, armed uprisings and, you know, bits and pieces in that kind of fairly tumultuous period. But I think, you know, really came to the conclusion, in fact, there's a very good passage where he talks about it somewhere, where, you know, basically we could change our rulers, but it wouldn't change the human heart. And actually, you know, this pursuit of utopia through revolution is never gonna, you know, we need something else. Colonialism, it's either blindness on my part or his part, I'm not sure which, but I can't think of anything when he addressed it, you know, those kinds of global issues, which, you know, Britain had a lot to address in its own time. I think he was very much concerned for the workers in this country, and the soldiers. But yeah, he certainly had that kind of orientation and got in a lot of trouble at different times, you know, for things that he said or wrote.
Just also, like, in my head, I was just thinking about how it sounds like his formative years obviously played a large part in his own heart and his own transformation, and his, like, making sense of his faith from having experienced and seen severe suffering, and how our experience of suffering and all, think now about kind of contemporary Britain, there, you know, actually in some ways because of the way in which we experience via the media the suffering, but always detached, removed from us, and very few, so just like the way in which inequalities are actually increasingly further and further apart, our experience of suffering is often not localized, especially in a country such as this. And what does that mean if actually the experience of suffering is obviously very crucial to understanding the heart of Christ, how, in the absence of, or how does our different forms of our experience or facing suffering, even in the absence of that being human to human, very direct, how does that actually change our own conceptualization of suffering and our understanding of Christ? It's just a question.
That's a really interesting question.
Yeah. No, I think I'd argue that, you know, even though we're in the UK, people still experience serious degrees of suffering, and maybe not on a large scale, but certainly there are countless cases of people who have severe abuse and who live in poverty and face real suffering and difficulty every day. So I hear your point, but I do think that.
But I absolutely just have to go a few kilometers outside of Oxford, but when you're looking at how you yourself perceive that in relation to seeing someone being brutally murdered by ISIS, you know, how you make, it's just this, like, you can just see
that kind of mediated,
how you make sense of your own suffering and at different people in different positions. But I think your point's spot on, and that, like, seeing the suffering of the married man, and you know, that, I think we also look for the worst types, but suffering exists in all sorts of, and there's all sorts of privileged forms of suffering too. But
and it's funny, I was upset with myself yesterday afternoon when I read the Observer newspaper, and I read an article about a Syrian man who had lost his wife and children on one of the ships coming over from, you know, Libya to Italy. And he talked about the fact that, you know, he was a surgeon, he'd run his own sort of clinic, you know, in his hometown in Syria before the war, been very wealthy, very well educated. He had all his documents, he had, you know, he was coming to Europe to work as a surgeon, but this is the only way they could get there. And he talked about on that boat of sort of 200 people that sank, you know, he said there were 40 doctors. And why does that change my perception, you know, of those refugees? You know, why does that kind of gets me? I know a lot of doctors, you know, not least here. And that, that sort of changes the mediation in some way for me. You know, he's no longer, you know, we kind of know these things physically, but we are, the way in which we receive these kinds of messages is hugely important. And I think that kind of the sort of mediated media, you know, sort of transmitted suffering is a really weird thing. And so actually the guy who examined my doctorate, I can't think of the name of his book, but his name's Jolyon Mitchell, and he worked for many years for the BBC. He's now a theologian at Edinburgh. And he's got a book on precisely that violence in the news and how it impacts us. I can't remember what it's called, but it's on exactly that subject. But I think it's a really important one because, yeah, it changes our experience hugely, the way in which we receive these things.
Do you think, have you thought too much the degree to which he's prophetic for today's church and for those of us who don't necessarily put ourselves out there as much as we maybe feel we should when we read some of his poems and that kind of thing? And yeah, just if you thought through that.
Yeah. So I think the answer is I absolutely do. And in a very weak and faltering way, that was why I bothered to try and, you know, write the book, because I think he has got a really powerful message for us that we need to hear. And so one of the chapters in the book, which is just obviously taken from writing, is basically called Where, What on Earth is the, you know, something like, what the F is the church doing here? You know, because he would find, he tells some very funny stories of him crawling through the mud on the front line and people sort of saying basically, you know, think he's under, who are you, or some kind of, you know, well, I'm the chaplain, and say, what is the chaplain doing here? You know, his sort of message that actually, well, those are precisely the kind of places that Christians should be, I think is a very powerful one. Mm-hmm. And just that sensitivity to suffering, I think, you know, the unfortunate fact is that, you know, the Christian church in the UK, even, let's not talk about the rest of the world, is clustered, you know, it's hugely demographically biased towards the nicest, leafiest suburbs of the country. Mm-hmm. And in my particular, you know, role, so I'm a priest in the Church of England, you know, the church I'm working, St. Clement's, we just had a vacancy looking for a new minister. We had, I think, 28 good applications. A parish in Leeds, where he came from and he chose to work, they wouldn't be able to find a Church of England minister to go there. And I think that's problematic, to put it mildly, for us today. So I think his kind of voice is powerful there. Says he from leafy Oxford.
Well, I have a question, maybe follows up on that, maybe the same answer, so you can say, you can. But how did studying, writing this book and studying his life, how did it affect you? How did it change the way you think about your own vocation or your own role or your own theology? What was that? What was the most transformative part of that work?
That's a good question. I find you know, his. At one stage, certainly thinking about the book, I can't remember what made it into it, but you know, I thought and talked a lot about his kind of soft heart and his sharp mind. He was a very, very bright guy, but he, you know, allied that with this real, you know, concern for, you know, for the people around him. And, you know, I think that's very challenging. I'm nothing like as bright as he is. But, you know, it's easy. There's a book. Has anybody read a book called Unapologetic by Francis Stafford? It's basically it's an apology for Christian faith from someone who's sort of, you know, very liberal Christian but brilliant thinker and writer, and he wrote it a year or two ago. And he talks about, you know, how if you were an alien, you know, and all you saw was advertising, you know, you would think that every human being was, and his word is buff, which I think is a kind of American word, but he's English, but you know, he uses that word, you know, that everybody is basically aged between sort of, you know, 25 and 40, and, you know, very wealthy, very good looking, fantastic network of friends, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I think, you know, the fact is that's not actually the reality of the human race for, you know, for anybody or for many. You know, and I think just that, you know, looking, you know, being willing to engage with what's actually going on, the kind of questions that Hannah's asking, not just, you know, turning off the news at 10:30 and saying, well, you know, that's sad about Nepal or about, you know, the refugees, but actually being willing to take a risk and get involved in those kinds of things. But it's a challenge more than one that I think I've, you know, acted upon. And I do think the theology, I mean, I think, you know, I'm not sure that he came to the right conclusions, but I think as Christians, if we're too easily satisfied, you know, with the classic kind of answers of, you know, if we think we have a nice little argument that we can run against the suffering in the world, I think we're standing on very thin ice. And I think the really real engagement with that is very challenging.
Maybe one, possibly two more questions.
Mm-hmm. If there are.
There may not be. No more?
I think we're good.
All right. Well, let's thank Jonathan again. Excellent. Yeah, so just to close things out, a couple of notes. One is we have this really flashy Trinity term card, which our previous committee has come up with, and it's very good.